You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Hey, Don, it says there's going to be a heat wave coming up. What's a heat wave? Anyway,
how do you find that? You remember these? Yes. We have a heat advisory. I prefer that term. The National Weather Service is using a heat advisory term for the next 5 days, 4 days, something like that. I was kind of wondering how we all define heat wave. And as I thought about that, a meteorologist who's active on Facebook posted that it's 3 days over 100 degrees. That's how he defines it in our area. Okay, well, hate to say this, folks. We're not going to have a heat wave anymore because every time I click on the National Weather Service forecast for the Davis area, which gives me results from the Sacramento Executive Airport, and then I toggle over to look at what it says for Davis right now, today's date, August 20, 2025. Lois and I are preparing this for broadcast on August 21st. It's going to be 98 degrees today, which is hot by most people's standards. It is a few degrees above average for the time of year. Tonight will be 61, mostly clear. Thursday will be hot, 101 degrees. Okay, start of a heat wave, right? Thursday night, 61. Friday, now they're saying 99. So, well, there goes our heat
wave. Oh, it was over 100. Every morning at breakfast, we go through this thing. It was over 100 for 5 days in a row.
It depends on where you click and how much further into the east you go, as we've commented repeatedly. As you go inland, it's going to be hotter. But I'm looking at Davis now, and Friday is going to be 99, apparently, which is hot enough. Friday night will be 63. Saturday is going to be 97. Saturday night will be 62, and then cooling off Sunday to 94. And Sunday,
so that's
night,
only one day of over 100.
Yeah,
so that's normal.
That's not a heat wave. So Monday is sunny with a high near 92. Monday night 60, and Tuesday 91 degrees. So that, by the way, 91, 92 is our average high temperature this time of year. Night temperatures are going to be a little bit warm, especially the next couple evenings, but we're still talking 63 degrees. So it's not that uncomfortable, particularly compared to what you might see for the rest of the country. But it is a heat advisory, and we haven't had much of that. And so almost all of our conversations at our garden center with regard to pest problems, or what people think are pest problems, tend to move over onto how they're watering. And just to reiterate a point we've made 175 times so far this season, water more deeply, folks. You need to be watering your trees. I don't think we even need to go into that any further, except that we've got a few days of high temperature, then dropping back down to normal. What does that mean for gardening? Well, it's time for brassicas. It's time to start planting, or at least planning, for cabbage and cauliflower and broccoli and collards and all that kind of stuff. But nurseries, we now go through this kind of deliberation every week. The availability lists roll in. I look at the weather forecast and I try to decide how many people are really going to want six packs of Brussels sprouts this week. We bring them in. It is time to plant them. So then the question comes up, do I need to shade this or shelter it or something? No, just water it. Just water carefully. Check daily water as needed. These are little seedlings. They only have a 2x2 root system, by which I need 2x2 root system. They're going into the ground when it's going to be 95 to 100 degrees. Water in the morning before you leave. Water again, perhaps when you get home at the end of the day, if necessary. I don't usually find that necessary, but that daily, once a day watering is crucial for newly planted fall and winter vegetables. Yes, sir, it's August and we're talking fall and winter vegetables. There's no hurry except for Brussels sprouts. That you gotta get going on them. You really should plant them in July. August is okay. And I've tested this many times just out of curiosity. You know, plant a little bit later each season and see what happens. You know, when I do it with summer vegetables, I generally get fine results. But when I do it with Brussels sprouts, just so you know, the reason we emphasize this, when I plant late September, October, nurseries have them. They grow fine. They look fine. Everything looks like it's going right. February, March rolls around when they should be heading up and they just bolt and flower and they don't form the sprouts. It just doesn't work. So you really do need to get an early start with those. Brussels sprouts and rutabagas are the two cool season vegetables that need a long, long season. Choosing between.
Stop laughing, Don. Stop
I
laughing.
know there are people
Just
who love
because
them.
you don't like Brussels
Oh,
sprouts doesn't mean that I don't like Brussels
I
sprouts.
love Brussels sprouts. I didn't like them when my father grew them because they were full of aphids, and that is an issue with Brussels sprouts. And many people don't. I mean, there's a lot of people who find the smell of all the brassicas unpleasant when they're cooking. There's a sulfur compound that's released at the time of cooking. My mother would not cook my father's Brussels sprouts. She finally, I remember this, set up a Coleman cook stove out on the patio to boil the water to cook the
That's
Brussels
a
sprouts.
camp stove.
Yeah, camp stove, that's correct, because she did not like the smell of Brussels sprouts cooking, but she did love her husband. So she cooked the Brussels sprouts.
Did she cook cabbage? Because that smells the same.
She did not like cooked cabbage. No, she didn't like anything in that group cooked indoors, basically. But Brussels sprouts are probably the strongest smelling and strongest flavored of the batch. They get better taste when we get frost, so it's important to get them planted so you get a good start, so you can have them with a little kissed by a little frost to sweeten the flavor.
So, I have the solution. Frozen. So you can buy a bag of frozen Brussels sprouts. You can take out three at a time if you want just want some,
Heresy. This is heresy.
It's not heresy. And
Well,
then
actually, in
you
coast.
steam them in the microwave and for 3 minutes, and that's perfect.
Probably doesn't smell as bad, right? So, yeah, in
No.
the coastal climate of Southern California, for those of you who might be gardening there, I can tell you Brussels sprouts can actually function as a perennial. My father's would continue. They'd make it through the summer because the summer is quite mild there. And they would grow into these little shrub-like things. And then they'd go back into the winter and they would form their Brussels sprouts. So you could have, I remember
Oh,
lasting 3 or 4 years. Wonderful. Anyway, enough about
that
Brussels sprouts.
Coleman stove had to stay out on the back porch a
Yes,
lot.
yeah, so it's okay. In Southern California, you can cook on the back porch, you know, even in the middle of winter if necessary. There are two varieties out there, Long Island Improved and the other one. Let me get that information here because someone asked me what's the difference, and one of them is a little faster to produce than the other. Here we go. Choosing a Brussels sprouts variety. Long Island, this variety will grow well in most regions of the United States, but prefers a long, cool summer season, probably the one Dad was growing. Heirloom variety, most widely planted type for decades, Long Island. Jade Cross was introduced in 1959 and was an All-America Selections winner. It's just a little faster, maybe 2 weeks faster to develop. And that has become the more popular variety because it's just so consistent and the sprouts are bigger and the flavor is apparently better. So the Jade Cross Brussels sprouts, according to one website, is rated one of the dozen top vegetable introductions by a panel of experts. So it got an All-America Selections Award in 1959. Long Island, Jade Cross, both do well. Jade Cross, marginally faster to produce. There you go.
Yeah.
Some of the other brassicas do benefit from an early planting. Old-fashioned cabbage. You know, if you look on the package and it says 120 days or something, that type should get in early. That makes a huge head of cabbage and very good flavor. There's a lot of newer types of cabbage. There's a lot of newer types of cauliflower. Those are the two other ones that we typically would recommend early planting on. The newer types produce faster. Get them in quickly if you can. You plant them too late, it's just disappointing because the plants don't develop. Now, if someone said, are they edible? Well, sure. I mean, any part of a brassica is edible. The flavor may not be spectacular. This is a real important thing about everything related to Brassica oleracea, everything in that group, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, kale, collards are all basically the same plant. They are all sweeter when it's cold. So their flavor in the warm season, even if they've gone into the late spring or into the summer, or you're getting or doing some harvest early, their texture is going to be tougher, they're going to be stringier, and their flavor is not going to be that desirable. Whereas when you get them kissed by a frost, you get a sweeter flavor. Enough about Brussels sprouts. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, if you like all this great programming, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And we have a couple of PSAs to do.
Well, I have information from the UC Davis Arboretum and Public Garden. Every Friday, at noon to one over at the Wyatt Deck is an acoustic jam session. You bring your guitar or your ears or whatever and go and hang out with them at lunch and have a good time. But then I found the next item says acoustic jam session. This is on Tuesdays from 11 to noon, again at the Wyatt Deck, but the C string ukulele band will be playing. And you can come play along with them if you want, or just come and listen again. So you've got lots of choices for music. And that's going to be August 26th, Tuesday, 11 a.m.
That's
And the
an
folk music jam session is every week, Friday at noon.
and these are at the Wyatt Pavilion, which is right near the redwood trees there in the Arboretum. If you haven't been to the Arboretum in a while, the layout's changed a little bit, to put it mildly. We do have some information from the Master Gardener. It's about their ongoing event.
Before we do that, you told me before we got on the air that I needed to mention Warren Roberts.
Oh, yes. Warren is, go ahead.
Warren is beginning to do his walk with Warren again. Thank goodness. I mean, we have missed those puns, and his sense of humor is just astonishing. His knowledge of plants is even more astonishing. Anyway,
Next one
you
is
could
September 17th is the first upcoming Walk with Warren. They'll be every few weeks. You can go to the events page at the Arboretum website, arboretum.ucdavis.edu. Renowned for his captivating storytelling and playful puns, Warren leads participants on an always engaging exploration of the Arboretum's seasonal highlights. It's open, free of charge. Anybody can come together and embrace the wonders of nature within the Arboretum's picturesque grounds. There is parking nearby on Garad Drive and other spaces. Of course, you can get there by bike or any of a number of ways. But check out the events page at the arboretum.ucdavis.edu site for more information on the walks with Warren. And then if you want to do any of the Master Gardener events, I went ahead and just Googled Yolo County Master Gardener, and up came the UC Master Gardener program of Yolo County, and we've been mentioning some of their online events and in-person events, and there is an events link here. And we have one coming up. It's the second part of a fruit tree series on August 28th, Everything You Need to Know About Fruit Trees, Part Two. So we'll just, leave part one, move on to part two. Once you've chosen your fruit tree and planted it correctly, how do you keep it fruitful? Bonnie Berman and Mike Kluck will cover pruning, pest management, special considerations as part of the Davis Library Master Gardener Zoom series. And you can go to that page I just mentioned, and there's a Zoom link there. That is August 28th from 3 to 4 p.m., part two, fruit trees. And there's a lot to learn about fruit trees. We live in an area where you can grow an amazing range of fruiting species, and it's great to know the differences, how to prune them correctly, and particularly pest control issues in our region. So, Master Gardeners, just as I said, I just Googled Yolo County Master Gardeners and had no trouble getting to a link at the ucanr.edu site for all of their events. So I got an email from my old friend Fred Hoffman, who does Garden Basics podcast. I did a conversation with him. He's editing it as we speak, and it should be on the air Friday morning, August 22nd. Fred Hoffman and I talked for 57 minutes about tomatoes. Everything you could possibly know or want to hear about this year's tomato garden, which is a different year because every year is different. If you want to find this, you can go to his podcast homepage site, gardenbasics.net, and there's a really cool picture there of his garden. Tomatoes overflowing from the raised planter, zinnias in a box nearby, a basket of perfect tomatoes on the edge of the box and the planter box in front of you, squash leaves off to the left. He managed to clean it perfectly, get every blemish out of there, and take an excellent picture of his garden. It's really hard to get these pictures composed this way. Beautiful picture, Fred. Gardenbasics.net. And that's, if you've been following Fred for years, he still has the old farmerfred.com, which was his website from way back when. And it's got all the articles he writes, and he does have a link to his newsletter that we talked about last week and link to the podcast. So farmerfred.com or gardenbasics.net. Either one of them will get you there. If you want to hear him and me talking real fast about tomatoes for 57 minutes or so, check it out. I'll just do one brief tomato update this week. I took in a fruit of each of two varieties that I've been recommending. One, which is Bodacious, last 4 or 5 years, highly recommend it. And then a new one, new to me this year and fairly new in the trade, Genuine, which is an heirloom hybrid. And took them in to have my staff sample them for flavor, because they're better judges of the quality and the style of flavor than I am, I think. And the comments were consistent. Genuine is new. It's got a really rich flavor. They all really liked the flavor. It was a good balance of sweet and tart and all that kind of stuff. The Bodacious was sweeter. So this tells you something, and they liked it, but the general consensus was that Genuine was a more powerful flavor overall. And this does tell you something about people's preferences for tomato flavor. Some people want a sweet tomato. That's a milder flavor, low acid tomato. I hear that a lot. I want a low acid tomato. Others prefer a stronger, richer flavor for sauces and salsas and for fresh use. So of the two, I've been touting Bodacious now for 3, 4, 5 years. It's a very good performer. I'm always looking for you folks for those good slicing tomatoes for BLT thing, you know, tomatoes that hold up when you cut them for a salad, that kind of thing. There's a lot of older tomatoes, a lot of the heirloom types, they soften very quickly. So we try and cut that for a sandwich or something. It's not going to be suitable. Well, new varieties that come along when the marketers are touting them for sandwiches and stuff, I want to try it out and see how it goes. Either of these will be good, but it seems that the Genuine would be a marked flavor. In other words, you're making the tomato a dominant flavor, and the Bodacious would be sweeter and perhaps milder. So go on both next year. Let me know how you feel. I'm saying the Genuine is a very good performer this year, but remember, I only recommend a variety after 2 years. And this year is going to be a little wonky because of the strange weather we've been having, the cooler conditions. So I'll do it again next year and make sure that it's going to produce 40 or 50 fruit next year, as it appears to be on track to doing so far this year.
So, Don, my tomato preference is always for something that has very few seeds that you can make a wonderful BLT out of. And so if you've got any of those Bodacious hanging around that you don't want, or because people like the other ones, hey, I'm always here available.
Bodacious is proving to be very good. It's when I first grew it, the first year, really good results. Thought, all right, second year, very good results. I have not had a bad year with it yet. And same thing with Rugby, when I've mentioned a number of times. So we'll give, you know, more reports as we go along. But the flavor difference on these two, fully ripened, you know, very in August, when they should be at their peak of flavor, there was that difference. And I ran into this years ago. Someone came into my store and said, I've moved here from the Midwest. Your tomatoes out here are all sour. I said, and I thought to myself, no, our tomatoes out here actually have flavor, but they have is that balance of sweet and tart. But varieties do differ. So if you've got one, you just never get sweet enough for you. Well, keep that in mind when you're purchasing tomatoes next year. Also, I want to throw this out there, because both of these, Genuine and Bodacious, are ones you're probably going to have to order seed for if you're going to grow it, because you're not going to find it at every garden center. Let's put it that way.
Hey, Don, did we have any frost last year? Somebody came in and asked this, and I thought, what a silly question.
Well, it's
of course we got cold.
Well, of course we did, but a lot of people seem to forget it when it happens. And we got a lot of people that seem to think we don't get frost in the Sacramento Valley anymore. Frost can occur on a night when the measured low temperature is not actually below 32. Frost can occur on a night when the measured low temperature at a weather station is 34 or 35 degrees. But we got below freezing in Davis 11 times last winter, and only once in November, twice in December, 7 times in January, and 4 of those were below 30. So not just below freezing, but into the upper 20s. So we are very firmly in Davis, in town, still in USDA Zone 9B. And I say this because it's people move here if they're new to the area. A lot of people moving to Davis right now, actually at the start of the school year. We've had all the sorority and fraternity kids coming in. They're the first back in town. Whole new crop of freshmen. People moving out of the dorms and into places where there's a yard and they'll actually have a garden for the first time. And someone said, I'm just really curious, you know, do we get frost here? Said, yes, we get 2 to 3 dozen visible frosts in a typical winter in Davis. Okay, USDA Zone 9B for sure. And we get nights that are cold enough to show frost that we may or may not have them, depending on the humidity. And we do get below 30. That's the important point. We get below 30 at least a few times, and we got below 30 4 times in Davis. We had a very cold spell in late January. This was important to me. I had a couple of young mandarin trees that were so badly injured that I ended up replacing them. Subtropical plants can be injured. In our area, where I am, we had 27 nights with potential frost, okay? And we had 16 of those in January. 12 of those were below 30. And on January 28th, it was 22.4 degrees. 22.4 degrees will do damage to young citrus of some types, particularly lemons and limes. Will definitely wipe out that hibiscus you shouldn't have bought if you bought one of the tropical hibiscus. Probably will injure young bougainvilleas if they haven't gotten established and woody enough. It was only one night, but it did last for several hours that we were below 25. And that was where we were out in the country outside of Dixon. Winters, likewise, 19 nights that were below freezing, seven of them below 30, and they got to 25.7 degrees on January 29th, which again is cold enough to do some damage. So we're not at the stage where you're going to be planting Guatemalan avocados out in your yard. We're not going to just casually sell you a bougainvillea and say, just go plant this on the fence. Tropical hibiscus are not hardy here. Many of these subtropicals, it's a spectrum. This is the thing. It's not like it is or isn't a subtropical. It's a spectrum. So within that category, we have mandevillas, which are technically diplodenias. They're hardy to about 30. They'll come back in the right microclimate. There's the tropical hibiscus will almost always be killed unless you have a very carefully chosen microclimate. But there are hardy versions of each of those things. And not every subtropical plant is equally vulnerable. Bougainvilleas are a good example. There's a couple of bougainvilleas that we have found are tougher plants that just seem to make it through. Bougainvillea spectabilis, the purple one, for example, comes through almost anything that we get here in the winter. Even the major freeze in 1990, when it was killed to the ground, it resprouted. The vigorous ones like Barbara Karst, San Diego Red, the reason I sell those is because they recover quickly from freezing weather. These newer dwarfer types do not typically come back real well. So it's a spectrum. A lot of garden centers just kind of put things out and figure you're on your own in terms of whether or not this is hardy in this region. We are not at the point where those subtropicals you love so much from Southern California can just be casually put out in the ground. So it's really important still to look for the right microclimate around your house. East-facing wall, the south-facing wall, an overhang of that building that traps some heat in there. And even better is to have a place where you can go out and cover the plant in its first winter or two, because for a lot of things, jacarandas, young citrus, bougainvilleas, even some of the more tender varieties, if you can get them through that first winter, they're usually going to be fine unless we get down to, 22 degrees. And again, that's more of a problem in the outlying areas. I'm very firmly on my farm in USDA zone 9A, if you're going by temperatures, because it's a 5-degree difference. We get below 25 degrees by my own records, having tracked it for 40 years here, about every second or third year. And that's cold enough, often enough to do injury to plants that you can probably grow if you're in town. So microclimate, where you are exactly, makes a big difference. But yes, we get plenty of frost and we do get cold enough at times to injure some of the plants you might be thinking of growing. I mention this because I'm seeing avocados in hardware chains, and many of them are Guatemalan avocados, which aren't hardy here. So just don't buy those, okay? Unless you're prepared to fully protect a plant that gets, 12 to 15 feet.
All right, let's take a letter. I really like this one. This is from Bob White. Hi, Bob, out in Elk Grove. And he writes, "Hello, Lois and Don. I remember hearing Don talk about a special grass blend that he had come up with. It includes a couple of types of either fescue or ryegrass seed. I haven't been able to find the podcast talking about that. Can you help me? I think remembering this sounded like a good mix to use when I reseed my lawn, probably in October. I love your show and have been working my way back in time, traveling through the archives. I'm back to September 2021. Hey, Bob, you got another 10 years to come.
More than that. Go back to 2005. The grass blend that I have come up with is a combination of a very fine fescue called Stonehenge fescue. It's a type of hard fescue with a very fine, narrow blade. A particular type of perennial ryegrass called Hat Trick, Hattrick. I see it spelled with two T's and one T. And there's a couple newer ones, like one called Fiji. These are fine-bladed, darker-leafed perennial ryegrass. Perennial ryegrass has been used. It's an extremely popular turf species, especially with people who manage large-scale turf, because it comes up quickly, it fills quickly, it's great for repair and all that kind of thing. But in general, perennial ryegrasses have been shiny and kind of bright green, so they didn't blend real well with the other grass that was already there. However, they make a really good lawn and they're really easy to seed in, so they're very, very popular with municipal turf managers and golf courses and such. The Hattrick and the Fiji and some newer ones are darker green, slower growing, and make a nice dense turf, and they come up quickly. So Hattrick Rye and Stonehenge Fine Fescue. And there's some other fine fescues out there, but this is a type that seems to be reasonably drought tolerant and can take a little bit shorter mowing than some of the other fine fescues, which is actually really important with fine fescues. The other thing we will blend in typically, we'll throw in some perennial, or some, excuse me, some creeping red fescue. So we have these, we sell them by the each, by the bulk, by the pound. We'll have them available. If someone needs some, we'll just go ahead and put them in a bag together. And we'll say, is there any shade? And if they say, yes, part of the lawn is shade, then let's throw in a couple scoops of creeping red fescue, because creeping red fescue is the most shade tolerant turf grass. If you look at an older neighborhood and the lawns have been mowed correctly, that is to say at least 2 to 3 inches high, the creeping red fescue will gradually come to dominate in shaded neighborhoods, Land Park in Sacramento, College Park in Davis, places with great high trees over them, where grass species are generally not super successful because of the shade. Creeping red fescue will take that. So we put that in as well. So 10 to 20% creeping red fescue, and then reasonably equal parts, doesn't matter that much, the exact proportions of the Hattrick or Fiji perennial ryegrass and the Stonehenge hard fescue. Just so you know, these are not things you're going to casually walk into most garden centers and find that way. Actually, grass seed is really frustrating to try and purchase, because the companies that sell it mostly sell nationally. They come up with the best blend they can think of that'll work everywhere, but there is no blend that works everywhere. They tend to put in some bluegrass, which I don't recommend because it just dies out here in the valley over about a 2 to 3 year period. And they'll put in some other things that might be more suitable in Oregon or, you know, in a rainier climate, but not here. So they can be okay, but they generally have some drawbacks. It's hard to find exactly what you're after. So there's a company that I get these from called Hearn Seed Company, H-E-A-R-N-E Seed Company, or Twin Cities Seed. Both of them are online, and that's who we get them from bulk to sell them to people by the pound. So you can shoot me an email at redwoodbarn@gmail.com if you want those links, and I can certainly follow up with that information, the names that I just gave you. But Hattrick and Stonehenge and some creeping red fescue. There you go.
So Don, if I were to plant this mix that you have and not mow it, how tall would it get?
Oh, I've let them grow out. I'm curious about that question. So I have let them grow out. Perennial ryegrass, the Hattrick, gets about a foot, and it takes a long time to bloom, which is very important for me because I got a kid who's really allergic to perennial ryegrass, and as am I. So I don't want it to flower. So that's one thing. It actually makes an interesting unmowed turf, and it took forever to flower. It only got about a foot tall, whereas regular old-fashioned perennial ryegrass, probably a foot and a half. The hard fescue in particular stays even shorter. It actually, in my opinion, the Stonehenge fescue and perhaps the Fiji, I haven't tested this one this way, would be a really good choice around stepstones, because it makes a really low 2 to 3 inch grass that maybe you would mow it once or twice a year just to make it less shaggy. And it's really got good potential, in my opinion, as a ground cover alternative in some situations, you know, where you're doing step stones and you want something to sort of hold them in place and you want a grass look, but you don't want to be mowing all the time. The Stonehenge fescue certainly has potential for that. Creeping red fescue is the one that is usually left unmowed. That's the one that's planted straight, not mixed with the others, in lightly shaded areas and allowed to grow more naturally. It makes a great ground cover. It looks like a meadow, and it's a soft texture and shiny dark green leaf, very attractive plant. It's vulnerable to thinning out badly if you mow it short in hot weather. This is true of all grasses. It's especially true of fescues, and it's especially true of creeping red fescue. So it's best to leave it unmowed if you possibly can. In that instance, you typically would just plant it pure because you don't want the different textures and, you know, the clumpiness of the one and the softer texture of the other. They look fine, but it's not the look most people are after. So if you're going to do that one, just do straight creeping red fescue. It's an excellent choice on the edge of a lawn where you're grading into more shade, or you maybe you want to take out your turf and have it grade, part of it and have it grade into a meadow. It would be good for bridging those two looks, the clipped lawn, the unmowed red fescue, the taller meadow grasses further back. It's become very popular. And as I say, in most older neighborhoods, it's one of the dominant turf species, unless people are mowing short, in which case it just thins out real badly.
Well, as you know, Don, and our listeners probably don't know, but you might remember that I don't have any lawn anymore. I got rid of that 20 years ago. But I have an area now where the undergrowth was all taken out and it's shaded. It's under a redwood tree. And I'm thinking that would be a kind of a nice thing to do, but I can't get out there, so I can never mow it. It'll be okay.
You don't
Creeping
need
red
to, yeah, you
fescue.
can, yeah, just go wait till the rainy season comes along. By the way, that goes for all of this. Wait till we're about to have a rainstorm. Make sure you have the grass on hand. The storm is coming in. You see the clouds off to the southwest. Run out there and fling some seed out and make sure it's on the ground. This is the important thing. There's a lot of things you can do to get a higher germination percentage, a more even turf, all that kind of stuff. But the main thing is the seed needs to be on the soil. So if there's a bunch of stuff in the way, the guy that comes through and cleans up your yard every now and then, if you've got someone coming in doing that, ask him to blow that area out in, let's say, the second week of October. And then you've got soil there, and you can just go ahead and fling it out there when the next storm is coming in. And this is really, lawns are easy to patch if you work with the weather. And areas that you're planting new are easy to work with if you just work with the weather. It's the people who are coming in April. Or now, wanting to fill in their lawn. Well, you're going to have to water a lot in order to get that to establish. But the key is touching the soil. And of course, when we did lawn renovations for people, we would always top dress with some compost. Old recommendations will use peat moss, whatever is available in your area that's inexpensive. The purpose of that is simply to keep moisture on the seed. The seed is vulnerable to drying out when it's germinating. That's when you're going to have the highest loss rate, is if you let it go dry, there's a north wind. When it's sprouting, it'll just fizzle out. A little top dressing with compost will give you just a better percentage, but you don't absolutely have to do that. If you do it right before a storm is coming in, it's going to be cloudy for a couple of days, and you've got especially a little warmer end of the season, October rain rather than, say, freezing rain in January. You'll get good results. But I have seeded lawns all the way in through December and started up again the first week of February and gotten good results. It just germinates more slowly, grows more slowly in cold weather, but there's less risk of it drying up. So get the seed, have it on hand, wait for a storm. This goes for your wildflowers too. I mean, to me, storms coming in are seed scattering weather. And whether it's grass seed under a tree or filling in the lawn or throwing the poppies out in that open area, that's one of the exciting things you can do when the weather is changing and a storm is about to come in.
So I have a situation where I will call it duff. That's what we called it when I was off firefighting. It's all the needles and twigs and stuff that fell off the redwood tree onto the ground and piled up in a thick layer, maybe 2 to 3 inches, It's wonderful. I love it. And I don't want to get rid of that. In fact, I have to fight with the person who's helping me in the yard because he wants to scrape it all off. And I'm going, no, don't disturb that. I like that. There's lots of things under there, living under there
Oh, it's
that
a
I
whole ecosystem. Yeah, it's actually great for the tree and it's great for certain types of plants.
So is there any seeds that will put down a strong enough root that if I put them on the top and they sprouted and kept moist, of course, that they would go down through the duff and into the soil?
Oh, any of a number of things, as long as you do it when we're going into moist weather. That's really the key, because that duff does that has a different moisture retention status than the soil below it. So that's a great place to scatter nasturtium seeds or creeping red fescue or both of them together. Great combination. Those
Oh,
are all things that,
you think the grass seed would work in there? Because it wouldn't be touching soil.
those roots will get down to soil.
All
Grass
right.
roots are very aggressive. The challenge is keeping it watered until they do. But as I say, if you wait until we're at the right time of year, that should be easy. And I mentioned nasturtiums just because they're so easy to grow. I mean, you can, and especially in a slightly shaded area. Nasturtiums, well, I won't go too far off on this topic, but nasturtiums like 50 to 85 degree temperatures. Well, don't we all? Okay. So that's what they prefer. And when it gets really hot, they kind of wither. And especially if they're in the sun, and when it gets really cold, the tops can be injured, but they usually come back. So they're kind of year round here. But excuse me, again, as I'm recording the show, I'm watching a major conflagration going on in my backyard between a tree squirrel and a scrub jay. and they're arguing over who gets to put nuts into the barrel. I'll fight. You know, I wouldn't argue with a scrub jay, dude. If I were you, I'd
No.
just take off right now. You're
Yeah.
not going to win this fight. wildlife interruption of the Davis Garden Show once again. I'm sorry, where were we? Anyway, nasturtiums are great in the spring and the fall. They make it through the summer and the winter, and they're really, really easy to grow. So that's one of the reasons I like to mention them for a spot like that. But yes, there are grasses you could do. Now, if you're a commercial gardener or something, this would be a real challenge because your customer is going to have variable results. If you want to get grass growing under a tree, like the creeping red fescue, the way to do it and have good results, pull away some of that duff and plant them out from 4-inch pots or gallon cans and hand water them. And then they'll grow up and over their duff, which will can the stuff will keep falling on them. With grasses, that's fine. There's lots of sedges that would work very, very well for this. So in the things like Achorus, which is a beautiful shiny leaf, and this one called Ogon, where the leaves are golden striped. These are plants that can take shade, give a grass-like look, but you're not going to seed them. Someone's going to plant them from either small pots or bigger pots, 2 to 3 foot centers, and you'll get a nice, they'll fill in very nicely as a ground cover. So there's lots of plants that give the grass-like look. Direct seeding is the challenge. Also, as you know, probably from experience, there's a lot of plants that'll run in over the top of that duff and root right on through it. In your case, I believe mock strawberry has done that in a big way in your yard once upon a time.
Perennial morning glory.
That's another one that will do it. Yes. And we don't particularly recommend either of those. But in the case of Viola heteracea, which is the Australian violet, or Viola labradorica, which is the Labrador violet, those are plants that are well-mannered in our climate, perhaps more invasive elsewhere. These are not the sweet violet. I mean, that would work, but use it with caution. The two that I mentioned, Australian violet and Labrador violet, they send runners, they root into duffy stuff, they root through it to the soil below, and they'll spend their whole life with half their roots in just this layer of compost stuff that Lois is describing. It's just breaking down needles and leaves and sticks and things like that. It's a great medium for lots of plants, but they have to be able to spend a big chunk of their life in this very loose material. Things that run over the top will do it. Ajuga is a possibility. So there's grass-like plants and perennials that'll work, but also perennials that'll run right over and root on in.
So the Australian violet that I had in that entire area, that was one of the things that accidentally got ripped out. How do I get more? Is that something I plant from seed, or
No,
do I
you just buy
get
it.
someone to put plant little
Plant,
pots?
buy one and plant it. So you'd be all
I
you need
want
to
it a
do.
little bit faster than
Okay, buy
that.
several and plant them. This is an interesting question. I
And
just had this conversation with someone who was wanting to redo an area, and can he get me the ground cover flats? And I said, well, honestly, no. Ground cover flats are part of our industry that's falling by the wayside. The solid flat, where it's all one flat of one thing, you know, rooted cuttings. There are still growers out there doing that. They're kind of specialty growers, and it's, you know, someone like my nursery, it's just very hard to get a hold of those things, baby's tears and all the other things you might be thinking of that way. So I've asked some of the landscape contractors that are customers. I said, what are you doing in this situation? What are you doing about ground covers? Because they don't feel like driving 3 hours out of their way to pick up ground cover flats from the small number of specialty growers. Oh, it's simple. We just use the 4-inch, the quart pots, or the gallon cans. They space them 2 to 3 feet apart and they charge accordingly. So it's become more expensive to do ground covers, but it's actually, you'll get better establishment rate this way because those flats were very challenging. You had a little 2 by 2 root system, and you're supposed to keep it watered through the first 3 to 4 weeks, probably daily, if not twice a day, depending on the time of year that you're planting it. These are bigger root systems. A good thorough soaking should hold it for a couple of days, at least one full day, and they just take better. It's just the issue is they actually have to plant a bigger plant, and of course, it costs more. But almost everything you can think of that used to be available in a ground cover flat is available in 4-inch or quart pots. So in your case, you're literally going to be sort of chiseling a planting spot between the roots, someone is, and then putting it in, backfilling around with what will now be a mix of soil and duff, hand watering, and bear in mind that you have a rather unique and strange soil there that you're watering for at least for the first few weeks. This is a really good project for the start of the rainy season. And you don't need that many. You could try a couple different things. And there's a bunch of ground covers that will work in that kind of shade, ranging from Vinca minor to Ajuga to the grasses we've talked about, the sedges and so forth. I do urge, though, for folks who are interested to look for two. If you want a little touch of color in the shade of a tree like this and that kind of leafy duff debris, the Achorus that I mentioned, Achorus ogon with this golden leaf, and the Japanese forest grass, which has the rather complicated name, Hakonikoa macroaureola. Japanese forest.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Japanese forest grass. It's beautiful and it's golden green, but it's deciduous. So it mixes nicely with some of the other things you might consider, and it's just bare in the wintertime. So make sure you have something in there that looks good in the winter. It actually mixes really nicely with finer leafed grasses. A nice combination is a fescue with that Hakonikoa grass, Japanese forest grass.
And how do I get seeds or starts from the Ribes viburnifolium? I had it, and it's one of those things you plant one, and then it sends up a shoot which arches over gently,
Oh, yeah.
touches the soil, and roots down, and now you've got two.
It roots
Well,
pretty
I'm
easily.
down to one.
Well, they root pretty readily at the right time of year. We've taken cuttings of them, and we find that fall or spring, they work well. So try some cuttings in October, late September, early October. Of course, nurseries do sell that one. Most of us in the garden center business who are not specialists in one particular category of plants or another are looking at our displays right now for California native plants, because that is very seasonal, interestingly. The demand for those is in the fall. And that's when people come in looking for them. So we're all scrounging around trying to find a good assortment of California native plants appropriate to our region. So we'll have a good display when people start coming in as the weather turns and they're ready to start planning and planting. Ribes viburnifolium is not native to our area, but it does extremely well here. It's called the Catalina perfume. It's native to Catalina Islands, and it does very, very well in the shade of a tree, which is unusual to have a good, strong, woody native for the shade that does well here in the valley. That's a challenging category. And it spreads out, as Lois is describing, and then every now and then it'll throw an upright shoot. And if you don't want a 5-foot-tall Ribes viburnifolium, you should prune that out. But otherwise, basically strongly outward growth habit. Little tiny dark red, I don't even know how to, mahogany red flowers that are in fact fragrant, although you have to get way down there to smell them. We don't look at it and go, oh, wow, look, the Ribes viburnifolium is blooming. It's just kind of cute and pretty, but not showy like some of its relatives. But hummingbirds love them. And it blooms midwinter and into the spring, which is a time where we do have a native hummingbird that's actively foraging for food. So Ribes viburnifolium, we mentioned it a lot on this program because it's tough, shade tolerant. It's a woody plant that grows here in the valley, even though it's not native here. And that's a challenging category. And it can take watering or not. That's the other thing. It can go into a landscape where it's irrigated or into a low irrigation landscape. I have a plant of it that I put in 30 plus years ago. Some years it gets watered, some years it doesn't. It gets buried in oak leaves every fall, and it's just fine with that. So it's a great plant to mix with some of your other native plants or potentially low water shade garden plants.
Jane writes to us, "Hey, Dan and Lois, many of the fruits on my celebrity vine are mottled with yellow. Early Girl, right beside it, is not affected. Can you tell me what this is? Your friend, Jane," and this is from a hot inland Southern California valley.
So it's probably tomato spotted wilt virus. This is a virus that does transmit to tomato plants. Let me see if I can find who the transmitter is, who the vector is. I can't remember whether it's thrips or white flies. It's in the plant. It causes some distortion on the foliage. It causes leaf spotting, or excuse me, spotting on the fruit. The fruit is fine, but it's unattractive. And it was transmitted way back early in the growing cycle of the plant. So it's a tough one to control, unfortunately, because it's transmitted early in the season, and you don't really know it's there until you get later into the season. And the tomato spotted wilt virus symptoms are obvious on the unripe fruit, but they're really obvious as it starts to turn color, distinctive yellow spots indicating the virus. There are a lot of tomato varieties that have come on the market that are resistant to this. So if it is a big problem, as you're looking through seed catalogs, look for a TSWV as part of the alphabet soup that you're finding after descriptions of plant varieties. Here we go. Thrips. Thrips are the main vectors being the organism that transmits the disease. Thrips are everywhere in California, particularly the lowland areas. It's a native insect that was here before we were here. We brought the tomatoes. They're enjoying them. So there's not a whole lot you can do. My experience with thrips is that they come in off of the grasses as they're either drying off or they get mowed. So if you were an organic farmer and you wanted to sell perfect looking tomatoes at the farmer's market, you would make sure that your plants are covered with floating row cover at the time that the grassy weeds around you are being mowed down. You might even spray with an organic spray such as spinosad to kill the thrips. I don't think most home gardeners need to do the spray, but if you do have a chronic problem with this, wherever you're listening, and thrips are a pretty big problem in Yolo and Solano counties, then you may wish to go ahead and do the row cover. This is they call it floating row cover. It's the exact same stuff we sell you in the winter as frost blanket. So it's that kind of a gauze material, and it simply keeps the thrips from getting to the plant early in the season. And that's when the disease was transmitted. So if you're looking for an insecticide, the only one I can think of that would have prevented this would be spinosad. That's an organic spray, and it does a good job, but it does kill many beneficials as well. So you use it only as needed. If this is a problem for you, the timing for that would be as the plants are just getting going early in the season. Clear everything out at the end of the season. So that's important. But more important, there's a lot of weeds that are alternate hosts for the disease and that are hosts for the thrips. And so managing weeds is an important part of all this. Farmers would typically spray for the weeds. You can mow them, but be aware that when you do that, they are likely to fly off and into your garden. So you may need to cover them at the time that you mow your weeds around. That's really the only thing I can think of that a home gardener could really do other than one or two applications of the spinosad. Again, it's an organic spray, but read the label, follow the directions, because you want to use these things carefully if they're necessary at all. The fact that you got it on one plant this year and not on the other tells me you probably don't have a huge problem with this. And so my inclination would be next year, plant, see how it goes, get everything out of there at the end of the season, cut everything down, take all that leafy stuff away, you know, compost it elsewhere on the property if you're going to keep it around at all. And then next year, perhaps rig it up so that you can cover over the plants early in the season as an alternative to spraying, so that you could put that frost blanket row cover over them. Not a bad thing to have on early in the season anyway, because it warms things up a bit. So organic farmers will buy this stuff by the mile, and they put just like a hoop type of device over the planting bed so that a couple people can go out there with a bunch of clothespins and put this floating row cover over the whole bed early in the season. If you're planting in March or April, which you might be doing in Southern California, you can still get cold enough at night. This could help with that as well. So that's one way of helping to prevent the thrips carrying the disease and perhaps getting them off to a better start with warmer soil temperatures because of the floating row cover.
And it's edible.
Oh, yes. Doesn't hurt you at all. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the important part.
Yeah.
Can you still use these tomatoes even though they look wonky?
Yes.
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, here's a question that I think is going to take us a long time to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Though we've answered it probably a dozen times over the years. What is the best way to thoroughly get rid of bamboo? Do you cut it? Do you dig out the rhizomes? Do you grind them out? What do you do?
All of those will work. The key question I always have for someone who is wanting to know how to get rid of bamboo is, what are your intentions for the site where it is? Because if you're planning to re-landscape and put in new plants, then you just need to dig it out. There's nothing that makes it melt away or dissolve or compost in sight. Rhizomes of bamboo are very tough, woody pieces of the plant. They're as woody as the stem. They take 3 to 5 years to start to disintegrate in place. So even if you kill the plant, let's pretend there's some chemical that kills the plant. There isn't, but let's pretend there is. Then you would just have dead bamboo. You'd have all that woody stuff in the way. And the rhizome structure of bamboo, whether it's a clumper or a runner, is dense enough that not very many other plants can be planted into it or will grow through it very readily. In fact, the list of plants that grow under or with bamboo is pretty short. And something I've worked on over the years, because of course my mother and I edited the magazine of the American Bamboo Society for a long time. And every so often we would ask some landscaper out there who was active in the Bamboo Society, please, can you just send us a list or a quick article about what you plant with bamboo? And it's challenging because the rhizomes are so dense and so woody that it's very challenging. So if you're planning on re-landscaping, you need to have it physically removed. And in general, that's the only way to really get rid of bamboo. Whether you do it like we did when we had to take out a big clump and a guy with a bulldozer took it out, or whether you're like the customer I had who had a, let's see if I have this right, yet they had a 30-foot planter they had installed with things on the side to keep the bamboo from escaping, which worked very well. And they planted it with running bamboo. And 20 plus years later, they really liked it, but they finally decided they wanted to do something else with their yard, with that particular bed. So they hired a landscaper who was a landscape laborer who worked for a landscape contractor. But on his days off, he came over and spent an hour or two chopping out the rhizome mass. First, he cut it down completely, and he made sure it didn't resprout. So every shoot that came up, just step on it, break it off. Easiest thing to do. They're very fragile at that stage. So he wasn't going to let it reestablish. Then it was a matter of digging it up. So if I have this right, I might have it backwards. A 30-foot bed of bamboo, it took him 40 hours to dig out that solid mass of roots. It might have been 40 foot and 30 hours. I can't remember. Whatever the case, it was roughly that many hours. That seems like a lot of labor, but in those days they were paying $30 to $40 an hour. So between $1 and $2,000 for physical labor for a guy who was just doing it a couple hours at a time. That's the other thing. He just kind of worked on it over a number of weeks until he got it all out. He took a Pulaski and a hatchet and a shovel, and he just took it back a foot or two at a time, chopping, digging, chopping, digging. Bamboo roots, rhizomes generally don't go deep. That's the good news. It's generally within the top foot of soil, or shallower. It's running across the ground and creating its own duff and its own little ecosystem there, but it's going to be there for a long time. And so just physically chopping it out would turned out to be the simplest. Some people would use a sawzall in some parts of that process. Use it carefully, of course, but the sawzall will allow you to cut through the rhizomes that are just hard to chop through. So he did it a couple hours at a time. As I say, it was 30 to 40 hours for a 30 to 40 foot bed. Some combination of those numbers is roughly what it took. Just physical labor. Now, there's nothing else that's really going to work. If you have a big area, I remember printing an article on this years ago. Guy in Alabama, I think it was, who had an acre of bamboo on a multi-acre property. And he wasn't going to do anything with that particularly. He just wanted to get rid of the bamboo. He just took a great big mower, brush mower, mowed it down, did that 2 to 4 times a year. Anytime it started to come up again, he'd mow it again and just make absolutely sure it wouldn't reestablish, which is the biggest issue with bamboo. People are not diligent enough about the follow-up. And over a couple of year period, he sent us pictures. It thinned out almost 90% over just a couple of years. But then it was a matter of keeping after it, because even a little piece way down on the end, if you allow it to resprout, could run right back in. It's a vigorous plant, but it's a matter of just not letting it reestablish. A plant that's not photosynthesizing can't sustain a root system. Then the question is, how long can you tolerate those roots just lying there decaying? So if you want to replant, you got to get that all chopped out of there. But it depends on what you're going to do in the spot and when.
And if you think that the bamboo will dissolve quickly, remember, bamboo is used for buildings. This is not something that's going to, rot out in a season.
Well, yeah, not in a season. The bamboo for construction is generally soaked in boric acid to preserve it. But even if they don't, 2 to 3 years is not an unreasonable expectation for a bamboo structure. And in the ground, the rhizomes will take a very long time to decay. Now, you may be able to cut everything down, keep it from resprouting, chop out a few holes here and there to plant new plants, and just make sure the bamboo doesn't come back up. It's the follow-up that's really the case. I mean, just as with ivy and other plants like that, getting it all out physically is the first step, and then making sure it doesn't reestablish is the most important part. People often want to know, is there a spray? They're usually thinking of glyphosate or something like that. No, it doesn't really work. We've chatted. My father actually called Monsanto years ago to ask them, when he was active on the bamboo helpline, do you have any labeling on bamboo? And they said, well, we're told X this, they gave him some anecdotal comments, which I thought was really unusual for a pesticide company, that if you double the strength and do this, this, this. No, not really, because it's too far of a root system. So even a systemic herbicide applied to something here is simply not going to go in and kill out the whole root system. It just doesn't really work anyway. So let's not bother with that. Covering it, now this is an interesting one. Covering it with landscape fabric or something, it'll just push right through that. I guarantee there's enough energy stored in that root system for a bud that breaks and grows to push several feet without any leaves supporting it. And it does it fast. I have measured, I used to have a clumping bamboo called Beechey's bamboo, which gets to about 40 feet, has a 2-inch culm in our area, 3 to 4 inch in Southern California. It grows, it expands a foot a day. All right.
Wow.
So yeah, you see this shoot form and it's down there and it's developing all summer long. And then I started taking pictures of it way back when I, one of my first digital cameras, and I measured it and it was pushing up a foot a day from October 1 to October 31st. It went over 30 feet tall. So you've got something that's fast growing, and this is important. It's photosynthesizing in the wood. So any stem you see that's green is photosynthesizing. Photosynthesis doesn't just happen in leaves. It also happens in the stem if need be. And in the case of bamboo, it is happening in the stem. So once the plant is expanding, it's already feeding the roots again. That's the reason I mentioned that. Snap off that shoot as soon as you see it and keep that up. You can get rid of bamboo that way. So if you're patient, 3 to 5 years to kill out a big stand of bamboo. If you need to replant that area, you just got to dig it out, unfortunately.
Well, I don't know if you've heard of Margaret Roach. She's a PBS radio host, and she has a show called A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach. And she's very well known. Here's one of her quotes about gardening. "Gardening is not my hobby. It is my spiritual practice and my life partner."
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
We've got a catered alert. Come meet and mix with KDRT volunteers and fans and enjoy some live music with singer-songwriter Christopher Castles at August Suds and Sounds Meetup. You can join on Wednesday, August 28th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Armadillo Music on F Street between 2nd and 3rd in downtown Davis. Best known as the bass player in the Natalie Cortez Band and as a founding member of 50 Watt Heavy, Christopher Castles is also a singer-songwriter and solo acoustic performer with an old-school troubadour approach to music. This Suds and Sound set will be his first solo show in Davis since the Blue Mango in early 1990s. The set will include songs from his upcoming solo album, Muses, Aches, and Anthems. Suds and Sounds happens on the last Wednesday of each month. Mark your calendars and join the KDRT crew.